Well, it's my pleasure to introduce Mark Kaltoff, who's a historian at Hillsdale College, and a dear friend for 10 years now. And if there's one thing I can say about ASA meetings, yes, I learned a lot of things here, but the fellowship is second to none. So, Mark, optimistic evolutionist.
I wrote a very long paper for a lot of reasons. One of them reminded me of Pascal's comment after a letter to a friend begging forgiveness in a long letter, and he said, "I'm sorry, I'm writing a short one. It's been a busy summer." But this is a 23-page paper, which I will not read the entirety of, just parts of it. But if there's anyone who is still interested, should that happen, I've got about 10 copies here, and I'm happy to share that afterwards. I did. Because I didn't think PowerPoint would be available, give you something to look at for me. So you have a timeline with some of the major figures and even their pictures on the reverse side. So some idea of what I was going to talk about. I'm sorry, Aaron, not to go along around and flatter me by having more than 30 people here. The three people about whom I'm going to speak, I will forbear biographical details in great length, although that's a fun part of the storytelling. Henry Ward Beecher was born in 1813. Lacan in 23, and Wyman Babbitt in 1835. These three people were very influential in the late 19th century. The most recent biography, Henry Ward Beecher, is called the most famous man in America, and indeed he was by the end of his life. And 2 years before he died, he published a book in 1885 called Evolution and Religion. He was a close friend with two others here, Joseph Kant, who wrote a book on science and religion, reconciling the two, just a year before he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. He was a geologist who served 32 years in the faculty at UC Berkeley and was very influential, and especially his well-received 1888 book, Evolution, Its Nature, Evidences, and Relations with His Thought. Lyman Abbott was influenced by both of these men, and in the 1890s came out with three books, two of which are particularly germane to this topic, one called The Evolution of Christianity, the other called Theology and Evolutionists. These three all knew one another, they collaborated, they influenced, they admired one another, and while there have been a fair bit of study of them, there's been little of which I'm aware that considers the three together. So I'm calling the three of them together optimistic evolutionists, and with that I'll begin what I have to say here. Henry Ward Beecher welcomed what he called the universal fact of evolution as the divine method of creation, and he confidently asserted in his book Evolution and Religion that evolution is accepted as the method of creation by the whole scientific world, and the period of controversy is past and closed. Wyman Abbott wrote in his journal, Christian Union, in 1882, the time when ministers scoffed and derided Darwin and his disciples has forever passed. All scientific men today are evolutionists. Lacan went even further when he wrote that evolution is the grandest idea of modern science. It is thoroughly established, indeed far more certain than the law of gravitation, for it is not contingent, but a necessary truth. Beecher and his fellow optimists insisted that being Christian evolutionists mandated that they recast Christianity into an evolutionary mold. Evolution is God's way of doing things, wrote Abbott. The task he insisted was to restate the principles of Christian faith in terms of an evolutionary philosophy. Beecher agreed, evolution is certain to oblige theology to reconstruct its system, he wrote. Lacan, also convinced that evolution required what he called a fundamental reconstruction of religious thought, warned that failure to do so meant that the church will die. He later wrote, there can be no doubt that evolution must profoundly modify the traditional views of nature, of God, and of man. These optimists welcomed the transmutation hypothesis as new revelation and as a tool for ushering in the kingdom of God on earth. Beecher wrote, the age of inspiration has not perished, its sun has not set. All dogmas, doctrines, formulas, laws, and governments of the church must be judged. He echoed Francis Bacon's understanding of God's two books. We have two revelations, he explained. God's thought in the evolution of matter, and God's thought in the evolution of mind. But evolution was not merely a scientific description of God's book of works. Rather, it was an ideological lens through which all revelation, natural and revealed, was to be read. Beecher called the evolutionary philosophy a new interpreter of God's two revelations. Lyman Abbott voiced a similar theme when he wrote, the final belief, the belief that the Bible is a revelation from God, is not inconsistent with the belief that the Christian religion isn't an evolution. For revelation is not a final statement of truth crystallized in the dogma, but a gradual and progressive unveiling of the mind. The Bible is not fossilized truth in an amber book. As Beecher told his audiences that he hailed the evolutionary philosophy with joy, he conversely poured sarcastic contempt on Christians who voiced reservation about human evolution. Quote, as it is now, vaguely bigoted theologists, ignorant pietists, jealous churchmen, unintelligent men pretending to be ministers of God, with all manner of grimace and shallow ridicule and witless criticism and unproductive wisdom, enact the very feats of the monkey and attempt to prove the monkey was not their ancestor. This contempt for Christian anti-evolutionism sprung from a confident faith that the wedding of evolution with religion would be the first stage in establishing the kingdom of God on earth. Evolution will multiply the motives and facilities of righteousness, proclaimed Beecher. To resist evolutionary theology was, therefore, to resist the very hand of God. So just what sort of evolution was it that promised such grand things on behalf of righteousness and religion? For Beecher, the specifics were negotiable. He explained evolution by appealing to such a divergent lot as James Dwight Dana, Joseph LeConte, James McCosh, Asa Gray, George Mivart, and Herbert Spencer, all of whom he identified as men of profound Christian faith who substantially hold the theory of evolution. That such men held varied understandings of biological evolution and Christianity seemed either lost on Beecher or of no consequence. After all, what mattered most was that evolution was a set of fact, not the details of its mechanism. For Beecher, evolution was less a strictly scientific notion than a grand metaphysical vision of progress. He wrote, the vast universe is moving onward and upward in determinate lines and directions, while on the way the weak are perishing. There is a process that is carrying creation up to higher planes, so that the whole physical creation is organizing itself for a sublime march toward perfectness. The important factors for Beecher, then, were that evolution meant progress, and that the Genesis account was of no relevance. With these convictions, Wyman Abbott and LeConte agreed, as they went on to develop a more focused definition of evolution. The doctrine that Abbott said is that all life proceeds by natural and normal processes from lower to higher stages. LeConte provided the formal definition. Abbott, in his writing, borrowed it verbatim. Evolution is, explained LeConte, one, continuous progressive change, two, according to certain laws, and three, by means of resident forces. Of course, LeConte expanded considerably upon this bare-bones tripartite definition, progressive change, according to certain laws, by resident forces. He identified what he called six factors of evolution which were graded according to a scale of energy and according to historical order of introduction. Specifically, he identified what he called five graded planes through which life forms ascended according to what he identified as the law of the transmutation and successive elevation of matter and force. The upshot was a complicated amalgam of neologisms, Lamarckian theory, Darwinian selection, and vitalism, all woven together by threads of speculative imagination and determined rejection of divine transcendence. For LeConte, if God was anywhere, God was resident in nature, his term. He explained that the forces of nature are different forms of energy, and the laws of nature are the modes of operation of the omnipresent divine energy. At the heart of LeConte's evolutionism was a settled view of God as immanent, indwelling, resident in nature, as LeConte said, in every molecule and atom and directly determining every phenomenon and every event. Two things follow from this. First, the particulars of evolution's mechanism were shrouded in mushy mystery, even if they were called laws. Accordingly, LeConte was content to affirm that the most important factors of evolution are unknown. This permitted him freely to depart or to borrow from other scientific thinkers of his day, almost indiscriminately. Thus, his own theory emerged as a grand philosophical edifice, its pantheistic foundations resting firmly in midair, with natural forces equated to different forms of omnipresent divine energy and natural objects, simply the objectification of divine thought. Furthermore, LeConte's doctrine of divine immanence constituted the chief weapon in his defense of evolutionism against the charge that evolution falls to materialism. Either God operates in nature in a more direct way than we have been accustomed recently to think, he wrote in the 1887 pamphlet, or else nature operates itself and wants no God at all. There is no middle ground tenable. Lacan believed that his view of evolution had fully vanquished materialism. Perhaps it had, but at the price of removing miracles from Christianity. He wrote, "Once one clearly conceives the idea of God permeating nature and determining directly all its phenomena according to law, then the distinction between the natural and supernatural disappears from view, and with it disappears all the necessity of miracles. In fact, the word miracle, as we usually understand it, has no longer any meaning. According to this view, therefore, all is natural and all is supernatural, but none more than another." Lacan's immanentist theology and its corollary demise of the distinction between the natural and the supernatural carried important implications. Chief among them emerged the conclusion that everything evolved, God, nature, Christianity, even human understanding of these things. Wyman Abbott wrote a book called The Evolution of Christianity, in which he said both the Old and New Testaments are constructed by a process of natural selection. Particularly important in this affirmation of universal evolutionism stood the distinction these men drew between religion and theology. Religion, Abbott said, is the life of God in the soul of man. Theology, he said, was but a human science, subject to gross error. It is the science of religion. For Beecher, Lacan, and Abbott, religion needed to be emancipated from that outrageous complexity of unbearable systems of theology. Thickets of theological underbrush would be swept away, as would Beecher promise, quote, ancient dogmas which are either renounced or are falling into oblivion, end quote. As this happened, the ancient Augustinian distinction between the city of man and the city of God would collapse, and the kingdom of God would become progressively manifest on earth, as this would breed love, justice, and harmonies of intimacy and intercommunication, as Beecher said. Fueled by such millennial intentions, these optimistic evolutionists had few qualms about recasting old Christian doctrines, considered as a significant case their views of sin. Beecher dedicated an entire chapter to evolution and religion to, quote, the sinfulness of man. Therein he devoted considerable attention to what he called the whole theory of sin and its origin. He called it the lie at the base of the great evangelical systems of Christianity. In his judgment, he wrote, "I hate it." He wrote repeatedly, and he denounced what he called the old theory of sin for being mischievous, repulsive, unreasonable, immoral, and demoralizing. He condemned the doctrine of inherited original sin with a self-assured proclamation, quote, "I inherited from my father and mother as pure a nature as ever descended to a child. There is no drop of Adam's bad blood come through to me." The narrative of Genesis 3 had value, though, he conceded, quote, "If treated as a poem, it's both harmless and pleasing," end quote. But if treated as a fact, or as, quote, theology has treated it for 1,000 years, then it's an awful morass out of which have flowed down streams of mischief and poisonous influences. Further, Beecher maintained a theological vision in which he said there is no place found for Adam, and no place for any allusion, even to the malformed and monstrous doctrine of the fall of the race in Adam and its alleged terrific consequences, which have become the bedrock on which theology has been built. The fall of Adam and the imputation of his guilt to all posterity was a bastard belief of the Jews, grown up with other colossus and absurdities of Pharisaic theology, end quote. Not surprisingly, Beecher's rejection of original sin had other implications. Maintaining the premise that Adam's sin was his own and no one else's, Beecher concluded it never descended. There is none of it in all the world. As well might one say that education relieves men of the effects of Aesop's fables. Abbott was less sarcastic, but he reached the same conclusion. Quote, "Now the traditional Christian doctrine of the fall and of redemption is inconsistent with the doctrine of evolution. It's impossible to reconcile them." But this was not a great problem for him. In Abbott's chapter in Theology of an Evolutionist entitled The Genesis of Sin, Abbott shrugged with these words. Did Adam fall 6,000 years ago? It is immaterial. Lacan had even less concern for the Genesis narrative. So, with traditional notions of original sin and fall set aside, Beecher and several optimists were free to interpret realities of death and evil according to their upbeat ideology of progressive evolutionism. So, Beecher admitted, the theory of evolution is as much a theory of destruction and degradation as of development and building up. Death seems to be the instrument by which life itself is supplied with improvement and advancement. But in the long run, it was all for the good because death prepares the way for life, he wrote. Joseph LeConte was even more optimistic about the good to be found in evils of all sorts. His final chapter in Evolution and its Relation to Religious Thought bore the title Evolution and the Problem of Evil. Was the traditional problem of theodicy in fact sharpened by evolution, as many Christian scholars have asserted? Not for LeConte. Rather, in his Law of Evolution, he claimed to have found what he called, quote, the philosophic alchemy which can transmute evil into good, end quote. LeConte considered in order physical evil in the animal kingdom, physical evil in relation to man, organic evil and disease, and moral evil. In each case, the conclusion was the same. That which seemed evil at first was only seeming evil, or rather good in disguise. Evil of every sort, be it suffered by the individual and the struggling animal, or by the hurting and diseased human, or be it what he called the most dreadful evil, moral evil, all evil, he explained, had, quote, its roots in the necessary law of evolution. It was a necessary condition for all progress, and preeminently so for moral progress. With a grand display of question begging and circular reasoning, LeConte justified evil after evil. For example, the only way to overcome natural evils, such as heat and cold, tempests and floods, volcanoes and earthquakes, and the dread evil of disease, was the knowledge of the laws of nature, he says. But such knowledge could not be attained unless, first, natural evils existed, and, second, unless the presence of those evils required humans to seek knowledge by which to avoid them. Since evil was the necessary prerequisite to the search for a means to overcome evil, evil itself, LeConte insisted, was actually good. Quote, may we not then confidently generalize? May we not say that all physical evil is good in its general effect, and that every law of nature is beneficent in its general operation? And if some evils in specific operation it seems evil, it is only so through our ignorance. Ultimately, then, LeConte proclaimed, quote, all that we call evil, both in the material and spiritual world, is good. Of course, even such fantastic rhetorical maneuvering could not ease from plain view of sin's ubiquity. So Beecher, LeConte, and Abbott conceded that it was real. Quote, since all evolution, all progress is from a lower to a higher plane, explained LeConte, all evil consists in the dominance of the lower over the higher, all good in the rational use of the lower by the higher. So sin was real, but man could save himself from it by following Christ's example in overcoming his lower self. Beecher liked to think of Jesus as the model of what a human could become. As men did this, it was a fine spiritual thing, the progressive evolution of society, the pacing the arrival of heaven on earth. Well, with such a sublime prospect part of a grand divine plan, even if LeConte, Beecher, and Abbott had satisfied themselves with Darwin wouldn't, that evil posed no barrier to theistic belief, hadn't Darwin at least vanquished Paley and rendered the argument for the design of fossil of an extinct doctrine? How did these optimistic evolutionists respond? They did so not by rejecting the design, but by recasting Paley in an evolutionary mold. Beecher admitted, quote, the doctrine of evolution at first sight seems to destroy the theory of intelligent design, his word in 1885, by the way, theory of intelligent design. The design theory, which has been a stable argument for the proof of the existence of God and his attributes, seems to have been shaken from its former basis, end quote. But just as evil seemed at first a problem for these men, so now evolution seemed a challenge to the theory of intelligent design. Like Paley, Beecher argued by analogy, but on a grander scale. After rehearsing Paley's argument for a watchmaker from the instance of a single watch, Beecher proposed a watch factory, quote, where watches are created by hundreds of thousands by machinery. Quote, if it be an argument of design that a man can make one watch, is it not a sublimer argument of design that there could be a man existing who could create a manufactory turning out millions of watches, and by machinery too, so that the human hand has little to do but to adjust the parts already created by machines? He imagined too a loom that made oriental rugs, quote, a thousandfold more magnificently than human fingers did. His conclusion was obvious, that, quote, design by wholesale is grander than design by retail. LeConte echoed Beecher. He wrote about an infinite, immanent deity. The removal of man-like directness of separate actions of creation can't destroy the idea of design, said LeConte, but only modify our conception of the designer. Lyman Abbott, like Paley, and revived his watch argument in a strange way. He said, suppose this watch, which the man picks up, drops from itself in a year's time a little egg, and out of that egg there comes a perfect watch a year later. Does that show less intelligence or more? The processes of growth are infinitely more wonderful than the processes of manufacture. He went on talking about wooden cuckoo clocks versus real cuckoo birds that hatch their eggs, and concluded every time that growth is more wonderful than manufacture. Well, we're short on time, so let me conclude and see if we can make any kind of so what about this. A generation ago, there appeared a little book by a Hungarian scholar called Thomas Molnár. The book was called Utopia, the Perennial Heresy. He observed in it, quote, from time to time, the belief spreads among men that it is possible to construct an ideal society. Then the call is sounded for all to gather and to build it, the city of God on earth. The dream is utopia, but it leads to a denial of God and self-divinization, and that's the heresy. End quote. A similar theme was voiced by the philosopher Eric Vogelin in the 1950s in his book called The New Science of Politics. There, Vogelin offered an analysis of the nature of ideology, and he described its chief error as what he called, quote, the fallacious immanentization of the Christian eschaton, that is, the attempt to make heaven on earth. These two 20th century scholars understood some fundamentals that had escaped the view of the late 19th century optimists and evolutionists. The fundamentals these men understood included the grim truth that attempts to make heaven on earth invariably fail. The implementation of ideological schemes are more likely to create hellish consequences. That man is not evolving into God, that Christianity has always insisted on the distinction between the creature and the creator, and that Christianity is the religion of a hope for a kingdom of God, not of this world. Lodged in the hearts of the theological evolutionism's proponents was an abiding commitment to a superficial and dubious ideology, alluringly addressed in alignment with Christian theology. It was an ideology of progress, the aim of which was no less than establishing what Joseph Lacan and the others explicitly called, quote, a divine kingdom on earth, end quote. The motives were noble enough. The threat that needed to be answered was atheist materialism. It had to be answered without diminishing the grandeur of science. Further, if modern evolutionary perspective taught anything fixed, it seemed to teach that there were no fixed ideas, especially religious ideas. Thus, in order to reconcile religion and science, this meant had to romanticize Christian experience and set aside what they called stale and rigid creeds as fixed fossils and remnants of bygone days. The only way to save Christianity then was to alter it fundamentally by shedding historic doctrines associated with original sin, evil, sacraments, the divinity of Christ, divine transcendence, providence. The result, of course, was not genuine Christianity, but pantheism. For the pantheist, either everything is God or nothing is God. This was Lacan's analysis. Since materialism was intolerable, God must be fully immanent, so much so that his kingdom could be realized in man and upon the earth. A tempting dream, that is, collapsing the distinctions between heaven and earth, between the creature and the creator, between the natural and the supernatural, all toward the end of mankind on earth becoming like God. But was not this the promise with which the serpent attempted Eve? Much of the optimistic evolutionist project was aimed at what one historian has called a quest for cosmic comfort amid the fear that human beings confronted only in a different universe. Their self-appointed task was to recast Christianity in terms of evolution. Perhaps the richest irony was the result, an ideology that was faithful neither to the Christianity they claimed to preserve, nor to the science of evolutionary biology that emerged in the 20th century. While they transformed Christianity into pantheism, they advanced a squishy evolutionism barely recognizable to modern biology. Perhaps there is a moral to the story that could be conveyed through a historical analogy. Imagine the science and religion of a fashionable and orthodox cosmologist in the 14th century. He would, of course, have embraced the blessings of both the church and established astronomical opinion as he would have advanced Ptolemaic theocentric cosmology. But as the course of Western civilization has shown, his doing so was, in fact, a mistake both theological and scientific. Had a longer prudential vision been available to him, what would have been the correct thing to have done? It would have been to take the remarkably humble approach of embracing a provisional agnosticism regarding the cosmological question and how to relate it to Christianity. If such a humble perspective was missing at the dawn of the Renaissance, it's hardly any surprise that our upbeat, confident, late Victorian, progressive, optimist evolutionists, flushed with the thrush of change and industrial capitalism, were any different. Has the time now fully come that the beginning of the third millennium set aside the humble approach that would have saved figures of past eras from their confident mistakes? Is now the time to forge a solid union between evolution and Christianity? If recent publications are any indication, many scientists and Christians seem to think so as they develop and defend new species of theistic evolutionism. May I suggest, though, something more modest and more difficult? Let evolutionary science stand. Maintain orthodoxy in theology. But exercise caution in integrating the two. In other words, before baptizing evolutionary perspectives with a kenosis and understanding of divine action, before wrangling about intelligent design and its theological implications, before advancing a Christian evolutionism expressly crafted to support homosexuality, lesbianism, or transgenderism, before claiming to have discovered evolutionary biology hidden in the doctrine of the incarnation, before, in short, pressing either theology into the service of evolution or evolution into the service of theology, might there be wisdom in patient continued study? Might there be prudence in considering the option of provisional agnosticism of the grand questions of exactly how, or perhaps even whether, to detail the ways evolutionary theory and Christian faith are to be integrated? It's the option that would have saved both our pre-Copernican brothers and the Victorian optimistic evolutionists from errors, theological and scientific. Could it be the option that might just do the same for Christians contending with evolution today?
Mark, we have a couple minutes for questions.
Just enough to bother everyone.
Let me ask you about the origin. How about the origin of the world of evolution? I understand some of the
origin of the word evolution?
Yes.
I don't claim to be an etymologist. I'm not sure that I'm not sure what you're angling for. It means to talk. I mean, historical science recognizes it as an unfolding of that which was initially placed in something. You could go back and look at, say, the 17th century debates over embryology, whether we were looking at, say, pre-formation or epigenesis, that kind of thing. So the evolution is used as an unfolding of that which was initially placed there. So, the unfolding of it, whether it be in the egg or the sperm, for example.
My understanding was Darwin worried about
this. He did use the word transmutation a lot. In fact, in their 1859 origin, evolved appears, but only in the Latin aircraft.
Huxley actually starts using the
Thanks. I think the answer to your last question is an emphatic no. While I'm likely to be yes, I think the reason is this. It's fascinating listening to you talking about more recently promulgated and published books, and certainly you've got your information from, which is very likely. But we've already heard comments on the time between Darwin's publication of Origin of Species and the rise of the evolution protest movement in the 1920s. And then the arising of creation science and such like from the 50s and 60s onwards. Time is now extremely short. There are now a great deal more people who have been influenced by these matters. I feel that it's imperative on us to quickly catch up and regain the ground and have a relevant voice. And while it would be nice to agree with you, and it would be the prudent thing to do, time is not on our side. I welcome the comment.
Understood. Point well taken. Thank you. I take that to be the concern that there's a lot of bad theology and a lot of people who are attempting to integrate science and religion in sloppy and irresponsible ways. If that goes unanswered, then more damage will be done. Interestingly, it was that very concern that motivated the founding of the American Scientific Affiliation in 1941. In the mid-1930s, you had people like Harry Primer and George W. Christ, Science and Religion Association, the Daily Geology Society, and so forth, that were giving many Christians who were real scientists concern, and they founded the ASA at least to combat that. So, point well taken.
I think we'll have to wait and move on to our next session, to our next presenter. Get Mark afterwards, just to stay on time.
Sorry, I talked too long, but I'm happy to come.
Perfect, thank you. Thanks, Mark.